Well, here we are with the last batch of questions and comments that came in, which have been forwarded to me. So here we go. This is all in reference to Matthew 7 and the discussion that we are having about Matthew 7. And in that discussion, I mentioned that there was rabbis having a conversation which Jesus was a part of. And I mentioned Hillel, which was one of them, and he was Paul. So the Apostle Paul served under or taught under Gamaliel, and Gamaliel's teacher was this man named Hillel. So those are two contemporary teachers of Jesus. And there are some correspondences. And here we are specifically talking about Jesus and his relationship to unique to Jesus. It is a formulation that he made very important and that became a really important touchstone for the Jesus community. But we find variations of it in Jewish thinking. We actually find it in other places in the world as well. So it's not something that's being portrayed as unique to Jesus. And we can find some contemporaries summing up the law in similar ways. And then there's a question here of like, is there documents or resources to better understand the conversation happening between the rabbis of Jesus' time? There is a lot of stuff. From a Christian point of view, you could have a look at Kenneth Bailey. He's always really good. He writes these books like Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes, for example. Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, and Michael Bird have done a really good compendium called The New Testament and Its World, and they would put a whole lot of good stuff in there. I always like Richard Hayes. I always am a fan of Richard Hayes. He's done a lot of work on the Hebrew scriptures that are being quoted in the New Testament and the culture there. There is a lot. Those are some people that I always start with just because they're trustworthy guides. And then there are Jewish elements. There are Jews, contemporary Jews today, writing about the Jewish world of the New Testament. And that's worth looking up. I haven't engaged with it, but a classic in the field would be one by David Stern, and it's just the Jewish New Testament commentary. That he is a Jewish scholar who is annotating the New Testament and talking about how those ideas would have been understood in the first century. If you have a look at David Stern and David H. Stern, S-T-E-R-N, and Google him, then you might find other people around the David Stern conversation that are worth checking out. This leads us to the next question, which says, which people or scholars did you say have written about recognizing personhood? So another request for further resources. This is an interesting conversation about the development of the idea of personhood. I can't remember exactly who I mentioned in the original talk, so you can go back and listen to that. But I do know that there are some people who are quite figures in the field. So famously, a man named Charles Taylor wrote a book called Sources of the Self. He also wrote a large book called A Secular Age. And he is a historian of thought and a philosopher and a late convert, actually, to Roman Catholicism. So that's interesting. But he's written, in some ways, some of the definitive history of the emerging idea of personhood. Because it's not true that all people at all times of history have thought of their self in the same way that we have thought of ourselves. And in fact, the New Testament, the Judeo-Christian ideas are part of the story of the emerging sense of personhood, of what it is to be a self apart from other people, or what it is to be an authentic person. And the New Testament is part of that story. There's a man named Mark Vernon. He's written a good book recently called A Secret History of Christianity, which is looking at some of these emerging ideas in Greek and Jewish thought, which then culminate in the person of Jesus. And he's not writing as some kind of Bible scholar. He's writing as a historian of ideas. And that's really good because he's talking about the internalization or the personal appropriation of big ideas, which becomes an important thing for Christians and is part of our story of emerging personhood. And that's philosophical. There's quite a lot of that. David Bentley Hart, the book The Atheist Delusions, is quite good on this kind of stuff as well. talking about the moral revolution of the inner life and how the Christianity started to introduce to the global consciousness an idea of appropriating personal morality as opposed to group morality. And that's all part of the invention of the person. Bentley Hart is also interested in the developing legal and political frameworks around personhood. And here he crosses over with somebody, another classic in the field, named Rodney Stark, whose short little book, The Rise of Christianity, is a classic. Rodney Stark is a sociologist and a historian who is looking at what exactly was making Christianity so popular in the first three centuries. And a lot of his argument is based on this idea that the personhood was being developed and Christianity was offering a new way of existing, which was attractive, especially to people who didn't count as persons under the old regime. So Rodney Stark is really good. More recently, somebody named Tom Holland, not the Spider-Man actor, but actually a historian. He's not a professing Christian, but he is someone who recognizes the influence of Christianity on the shaping the Western, especially Western imagination. And he's also interested in this rise of personhood idea. I think I don't like Tom Holland so much. I mean, it's an interesting book, but I don't like it so much because he's very Christendom focused. Like he really thinks of Christianity as institutions and legal frameworks and big bullies striding across Europe, forcing the land to shape to their will. And that's not the vision of Christianity that I find very compelling personally. And also it's not Christianity, it's Christendom, which is a different thing. And Christendom has undoubtedly shaped a lot of our imaginations for good and for ill. Whereas the kinds of stuff we're doing here, and which I think Mark Vernon in his Secret History of Christianity, they're trying to pay attention to, well, there's more going on than just legal frameworks. And in fact, it's the institutionalization of the Christian movement that became a problem. It's like the Christian movement got absorbed back into the world that it was trying to change or that it could have changed. And that there's still something happening in the beating heart of the Jesus movement, which is actually a challenge to power structures, and it doesn't just reinforce common culture. It actually always challenges it. And that's the part that I find more interesting. Somebody like a Tom Holland doesn't notice that. He just looks at the cultural dynamics, which is part of the story, but there's always more going on. Soren Kierkegaard is somebody who really pays attention to how dynamite following Jesus is to Christendom, how destructive the way of Jesus is to a lot of Christian culture. And he's, as you know, somebody who's inspired me a lot. In the more modern era, you have Stanley Hauerwas, who I've talked about many times, Hauerwas. Check out his works. There's many of him. He's an essayist. He writes lots of essays rather than whole books. And he's well worth researching, just as an example of a modern day theologian who's aware of the subversive nature of following Jesus and who's highly critical of Christian laws and Christian cultures and Christian countries for these sort of reasons. But a lot of it is to do with this idea of personhood, of the idea that you can be an authentic person over and against the group that you were born into, that your whole identity of authentic self is not begun and ended when we just talk about what family you were born into or what country you were part of or what ethnic identity you have. The idea that your personhood is grounded in something other than the accident of your birth, which is something that puts the brakes on patriotism, it puts the brakes on tribalism, it puts the brakes on an allegiance to your family or your blood family above all else. And this is why the early Christians were considered to be quite subversive or quite dangerous, because they didn't have all those allegiances, and they didn't think that their blood family or their lineage or their inherited traditions defined them. And it's only in later history of Christian culture that Christians start to have their own inherited traditions and blood families and lineages, and they start to collapse this sense of identity back into their sense of national allegiance or family identity. So anyway, that's part of the story. And I'm much more interested in those forms of Christian life which don't accept the narratives that you were born into as being the sum total of your story. And that's why I'm drawn to people like Havras and Kierkegaard. A question here about the Protestant tradition being committed to salvation by faith alone and not works. So grace and not works. And I was making these comments talking about how in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is sort of unashamedly talking about how your destiny is going to be shaped by your works. That what happens to your life, the shape of your life, is going to be shaped by what you do. More important than what you say, more important than what you think or what doctrines you claim you believe, it's what you do that matters more. And more specifically, it's what you do in imitation of Jesus that matters if you do the things he actually asks you to do. And for the Sermon on the Mount, this has to do with being a peacemaker, with not being anxious about money or building your life around the gathering of a hoarding of goods. It means having some kind of non-enemy relationship to foreigners, non-exploitative relationship to other people. Those are the kinds of things that Jesus talks about. And it will come down to things like lay down your life for your friends, treat others better than yourself, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And these are the things that in the Sermon on the Mount come across for a lot of, especially Protestants and evangelicals, as works. So a lot of evangelicals get nervous about the Sermon on the Mount because they think that it's all about salvation by works, which has this long history. It's a very deep history to Protestantism. In fact, it's pretty much the reason Protestantism even exists. And here we're going back to the history of the Reformation. And this would be the medieval Roman Catholic Church, which had a culture of what I guess we would call works-based salvation. So the idea was that if you pay enough money or if you do the right things, then your loved ones or your own soul will spend less time in purgatory. And the church was able to release people from this time of purification in the afterlife. They were able to release people from purgatory quicker based on what those left behind, how they did and how they acted. An idea here that it was the church that was determining who got to get to heaven quicker or not, and it was all based on what they did on earth. And it involved things like acts of charity and not sinning and not lusting and not lying. But it also involved things like paying offerings to the church or buying what was called indulgences, which were fees that you would pay to the priest or to the pope in order to get more favor in purgatory. And this was the sort of activity which had become what I suppose you could call quite outer or religious. So there was not a lot of, it wasn't absent, but there was a lot of culture where you didn't have to really authentically own any of these things, of the things of Christ. You just had to go through the motions, attend Mass the right number of times, pay the right number of amount of money, that sort of thing. And this was the whole environment that Protestants like Martin Luther rebelled against, the German priest and scholar. And it was specifically against this indulgences idea that if you paid money, you would be released from purgatory or from hell. And it led to a whole revival and renewal in the church, in the Christian church. It became the idea that salvation is by faith alone. It is by grace you have been saved, not by works. And this was the Apostle Paul's works in Galatians, for example, and Luther is talking about Paul, and he's being inspired by his readings of Romans and Galatians to not see salvation as a matter of adherence to a set of laws, but seeing salvation as a statement of faith in the Lordship of Jesus Christ, and then salvation through faith alone. And I think it's fair to say that this was in some ways a necessary reformation, a necessary revolution to the church, the medieval church. It was definitely a corrective to an idea that had gone too far. It led to our ideas of an inward sense of being born again. It led to sola scriptura, seeing scripture alone as the arbiter of what is God's word or not, and not tradition or the church. It led to some interesting developments, some of them really good, some of them mixed. The Reformation was not a perfect movement, dropped out of heaven, fully formed. It had a lot of violence. It had a lot of appeal to the armed state in order to kill its enemies. Martin Luther availed himself of the state in order to wage war on or violently kill his enemies, as did the Roman Church. They were also availing themselves of violence in order to kill Protestants. Protestants were killing Catholics. It wasn't a good time in lots of ways. It wasn't very Christ-like in many, many ways, but it was a shift in the Christian consciousness, the Christian imagination. And in fact, it even led to a reform within the Roman Catholic Church as well. But it did lead to a split between Protestants and Catholics, the ones who were protesting against the Roman Church. And that's where we get evangelicals from, and modern day charismatics and Pentecostals, as well as Lutherans and Presbyterians and Calvinists and all the other types of Protestants. And this is quite deeply baked into the Protestant imagination, is that salvation must be through faith alone. It is by grace and not by your works, which has led to modern day evangelicals being deeply suspicious of anything to do with the idea that how you do something is how you will be judged, or that God actually likes your actions and wants to see you act well, not just think well, and not just say things well. To the extent that evangelicals are suspicious of Jesus' own words, so they like the idea of salvation by faith alone so much that they use that idea of Martin Luther's in the medieval Reformation, they use that idea to judge Jesus himself. And a lot of people have noticed that this is a real problem. This is the idolatry of something that had a useful life or that was good for the time and has now become a new idol. And I think this is a really clear example. And it just is simply not true. Well, first of all, the Apostle Paul and Jesus himself and the gospel writers, they're not rebelling against the Roman Catholic medieval church. The Roman Catholic medieval church had a problem with salvation by works. This is not what the Jews had in Jesus' age. This is not what the Jews had in Paul's age. Paul and Jesus are not waging a reformation against Roman Catholic medieval works-based religion. They're talking about something completely different. And the Jews of Jesus' time were not a works-based religion. But what they were was, if you are God's people, then this is what it means. This is what it looks like. So you are saved by God's choice. God's chosen you regardless of, he's chosen his people regardless of how good they are. But now that he has chosen you, this is how we act. And faith, works becomes the way that you show, or the implications or the consequences of being a chosen person. You don't do good works so that you will be a chosen person. You are a chosen person by grace, which leads to works. And this is exactly the sorts of things that the early Christians recognized about themselves as well. They didn't think they were doing good works in order to be saved or to be put into a life of fruitfulness rather than destruction. They recognized that Jesus has called them into a new life, and that it is not by anything they did, and it's not through anything they deserved. But now that they are part of that new life, new things happen. Things are going to come from that. Works are going to come from that. There are works that are expected of someone who is a chosen person, who has been one of Jesus's people. And this is where the Sermon on the Mount comes in. It is the rule of life for the people of God, or a new rule of life for the new people of God. And this is where Jesus says, I expect you to act this way. And if you don't act this way, then you're going to be like the goats who are separated from the sheep. And the goats are sent to the place of utter destruction and uselessness. Whereas the sheep, who know my voice and know my name, they're the ones who are living fruitful lives, saved lives. And you can know them by their works. And there's all sorts of stories in the New Testament where Jesus talks about this, that he cares more about people doing the things rather than talking about it. And he cares not very much at all about doctrinal correctness. He cares more about love. You will know that they will know you are my people by how you love, which is a works-based object, right? This has to do with how you act towards others, how they receive your attention, how it feels to be around you. That is how we're going to be able to judge whether you are my people or not. And that's where all this is coming from. So the Jesus saves not on it based on anything you did, but what he saved you into was a life of good works. He saved you into a life where you get to work well. And how you know whether you're working well or not is based on texts like the Sermon on the Mount. Rules of living that guide what is the right works and good things to do. And again, the book of James makes this very clear that if you just talk a lot about the gospel but don't love somebody, then if that's not the gospel. And he says, if you show me your faith without works is dead. There's no point just talking about a thing if people around you aren't being loved. So that's where faith and works has a relationship that are definitely connected, which is not the same as a Roman Catholic salvation by works alone. And I think that Jesus teaching has something to say to everybody all the time. And it isn't something we should explain away just because we think we are saved by faith and not by our works, because that's not what Jesus is talking about. When Jesus spoke about how every good tree bears good fruit and vice versa, could that be pointing us to the inherent goodness in every human? If no bad tree can bear any good fruit, it seems to me that any person who has ever done anything good would be classified as good, because a bad tree wouldn't be able to have that fruit. I suppose you could say that the opposite of the good tree, I'm just thinking about trees in the image of grace and humanity, and all of us being made in the image and likeness of God. This passage could also not apply to humans at all. Yeah, right? I mean, it's one of these phrases where it sort of reveals a lot about a person. And I find it really interesting that whoever wrote that question, to me, it reveals something really true and good about your heart, that you immediately went to thinking, well, I know bad people that produce good, have done good things. Does that mean, that must mean that Jesus is saying they're good trees? Whereas something about my heart, which is a bit more cynical and twisted, I always think of it the other way around. I always use it in my heart to judge people and to say, nothing good can come of that. Even if it looks good, they're not good, because no good thing can come from a bad tree. So I find this really interesting. Once again, the words of Jesus are the images he uses, the parables he uses defy a real ability to just cut and dry judge someone. And it almost reveals the secrets of the heart more than anything else. And I find this interesting. It's part of what we went back to, the idea of an authentic personhood, that one of the things Jesus is doing is he's refusing to give us some kind of cut and dried list of what a good person is and what a bad person is. He's much more trying to find out that you have a good heart, and that it's almost like he's not really worried about how you care for the poor or how you're a peacemaker. He just cares that you do it. Whereas a lot of us really care about how. And here we're seeing a return back to the self again, to the inner self. And even here, your interpretation of this is, I guess this means everybody is good. Whereas my translation was, I guess this means we're all bad. And it shows me something about my human heart, which is worth pointing out. I'm being put back into myself again and wondering, is my heart right? Am I judging people? Am I finding any excuse I can to judge people? I don't know how this works, because I actually have asked Brad Jerzak about this, and I think there's a recording of it. If you're on the Patreon, do listen to the Patreon conversation I had with Brad Jerzak, because I have asked him about this. I always wonder about this. Can a good tree bear bad fruit, or can a bad tree bear good fruit? Because I think on one hand, it obviously it seems true, as you just pointed out, that people do good things, even though they're silly or twisted or ignorant or foolish or whatever. However, there are some other ways of thinking about this. And I'm reminded of the thing we've been talking about the separating the sheep from the goats. And also here in the sermon in Matthew 7, the idea that not everyone, the people who are raising the dead and healing the sick, and Jesus says, I don't know you. Again, there's a sense that the fruits aren't actually the acts in the moment. That you could be somebody who looks like you're doing all sorts of good things and you're still classified as a quote-unquote bad tree, that you'd still be useless to the kingdom. And I think there's something here as well, and I'm trying to not go straight into judgmentalism, because you've just reminded me that how judgy my own heart is. But this is where I wonder whether there's something going on here about, don't just look at the idea of fruits and trees is one of longevity, or in it for the long haul. One of the things you notice is that the Israel called itself a fig tree, for example. And that was one of its images, one of the popular images that Israel used for itself, about itself. So when Jesus is talking about trees, he's not just talking about individuals. He might be talking about groups as well. He's talking about organized, collective, long-standing human institutions. They're also trees. And you are meant to discern or notice that if those institutions have been formed or rooted in the wrong kind of soil or formed around the wrong things, then everything they produce will be wrong in some way. And it's possible to have a vibrant, popular, active group, which is also a group in which is not loving or knowing the words of Jesus at all. And so then you can say, well, their fruits, although plentiful, are bad. And there's something of that going on here, too. It's a bit of a collective, I want to say judgment. Well, it's a judgment. It's one of these things where, again, if we're thinking in terms of judgment as moral discernment, as opposed to judgment as sweeping condemnation, we can say that we recognize that we are part of institutions that like to talk about how much they've done and all the things they've done. We're part of groups where the leaders like to talk about how many things they're doing or what they're doing. And maybe it's not a bad idea to think, what if we didn't just look at the immediate effect of their results, but what if we considered the longer term, bigger picture fruits that are coming from these sorts of cultures? Are they cultures which are producing disciples in the form of Jesus? Are they producing people who regularly love the things that Jesus loved? Right? And that's where I do look at some of our Christian cultures, and I do recognize that there's individual good people inside them, but a lot of our Christian cultures manifestly, evidently, demonstrably do not produce people who like Jesus or the way of Jesus. And I would call those bad fruits. I would call those systems of life, those habits of life, those denominations or Christian cultures, what have you, however we describe the apparatus of Christendom, I would say, yeah, it's possible to look at that and say, bad trees produce bad fruit. And that doesn't mean the individuals within these trees are evil and unredeemable. It just means that they are not being shaped. Their imaginations are not being shaped well. Their morality and their ethical compass is not being shaped well. Their actions, their imaginations of how they should act, their sense of power, none of these things are being shaped towards a Jesus way of life. They're being shaped towards something else, a kind of a Christian culture way of life. And they might talk a lot about all the people they've healed and the dead they've raised and the demons they've exorcised. And Jesus can turn to them and say, I don't know you. And I guess that's where I want to end, to accept that there is a personal dimension to it, to accept that I shouldn't be an internally judging person, and at the same time to recognize that I am part of systems which are bad, that I have been shaped by systems which are not good, and I need to be retrained. I need to be reformed. I need the Sermon on the Mount to redeem me. Well, friends, thank you for following us on this journey through the Sermon on the Mount. I think this is where we're going to stop, and I look forward to talking to you someday in the future. But until then, bless you.